Welcome to Seed to Scale.
We're four investors with backgrounds as founders who met at the engineering school at the University of Pennsylvania.
Tim Young.
Nihal Mehta.
Hadley Harris.
Vic Singh.
We started ENIAC in 2009.
With more than 80 years of combined experience building our own companies.
We now lead seed rounds and bold founders who use code to create transformational companies.
Starting a company from the ground up is really hard.
In this podcast, we'll be having conversations with some of the most interesting founders, investors, and influencers.
About the ins and outs of building an early stage company.
We talk about it all.
Funding, growth, and everything it takes to build a lasting business.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to Seed to Scale. I'm Hadley Harris, founding general partner at ENIAC Ventures, and I couldn't be more excited to bring you today Brad Feld, a man who needs no introduction, a great entrepreneur, investor, author, blogger, speaker, marathon runner, and all-around good guy.
I believe there are multiple ways to create successful venture funds, and there are multiple strategies in terms of how you invest.
We got to spend time with Brad last summer when my partners and I were in Boulder for a team offsite. It's really helpful for us to be able to ask him questions since Foundry also has four founding partners. When we decided to have this podcast, we knew he'd be a great guest, so I'm super excited to have him on the show today. Hey, Brad, thanks for being on the show.
My pleasure. Happy to be here.
I'm sure you've had to run through your background thousands of times, but for those that are living under a rock or maybe new to the industry, would you mind giving us just the real quick and dirty run through of your background and how you got to this point?
Sure. Today, I'm a partner at a venture fund called Foundry Group. We're based in Boulder, Colorado. We invest all around the U.S. We also invest 30% of our funds in other early stage venture funds. I also co-founded Techstars. Prior to that, I had started another venture capital firm, a firm that eventually became known as Mobius Venture Capital. It was originally a spinoff from SoftBank in the 1990s. And prior to that, I was a founder of a company called very creatively Feld Technologies, which I started with a friend of mine, Dave Jilk. We ran it self-funded for 7 years and then sold it to a public company in 1993 called Ameridata. And I worked with them for a couple of years. And I really had never done any sort of investing or M&A activity up to that point.
Curious, if you had to go back and kind of talk to yourself back around those early days when you started investing as a venture capitalist and impart some knowledge to yourself, what would be that top thing you would impart in, say, kind of a five-minute conversation?
To recognize that it's much easier to make an investment in a company than it is to exit an investment in a company. And as a VC, sort of institutional investor versus investing with your own money, understanding what your long-term strategy is, not just in terms of your entry into companies, but how you're thinking about how those companies are going to evolve over time and what kind of businesses they're going to turn into, and how as an investor, you're going to actually, you know, take your investment dollars into private company equity and then ultimately exit back into either public company stock or cash. And recognizing that the bulk of the work happens after you make that first investment.
There's been this huge rise of these quote unquote full stack super funds that have raised really large funds that have built out large teams of not only their GPs, but junior investment professionals, and then folks who will help along the way with a bunch of different functions around business development and operations and finance. That's something that it seems like you guys have almost gone the other direction and really tried to focus on keeping the team quite small, being GP-led. What do you think of this rise of these super funds? Is it just bullshit to rationalize a massive AUM, or do you think there's some, you know, validity to it?
I think the right answer is probably check back in, you know, in a decade or two and see how those funds performed. So it's hard to know. I believe there are multiple ways to create successful venture funds, and there are multiple strategies in terms of how you invest. For me and for my partners at Foundry, one of our deeply held beliefs is that you should have a strategy that extends over a very long period of time. Versus a strategy that's constantly changing. And that was a big lesson from the bubble where you had, venture firms, in some cases, even very successful venture firms from, you know, even earlier than the mid 90s, you know, going back into the 80s, that sort of in the late 90s, all of a sudden started chasing returns, chasing dynamics, changing around how they were doing, expanding the amount of capital dramatically, not being deliberate about what they were doing, but just reacting to the fact that, you know, we were on this sharp upward rise. And, you know, I was certainly at SoftBank in the middle of a lot of that similar kind of activity. I mean, our funds grew very, very quickly and our team grew very large. We went from an initial four partners and I think we had two EAs. I think at the peak, we had over 70 people in the organization.
Wow.
And when we started Foundry in 2007, we stepped back and said, you know, what are we going to do? What are deeply held beliefs and what's our 30-year strategy? And one of our deeply held beliefs was that we would always be a very small organization. So our whole organization is 16 people. I'm very confident in our strategy, and I don't really feel like it's important to know whether the other strategies will work or not.
Sure.
I think what's more important for a venture fund is to have conviction and consistency around their own strategy.
How about as industry as a whole, do you feel like the current situation is sustainable in terms of just the amount of money that's coming in versus the opportunity to invest that money in great companies?
Well, I'm very bullish long term. One of my heroic figures is Warren Buffett, although I would categorize it as there's plenty of things that differ on, but there's lots of things that are very interesting to me. And it sort of ties back to the question and how I would answer your question, which is everything runs in cycles and you can't predict the cycles. And the cycles have lots of exogenous factors, as well as things that are inside the characteristic of whatever the industry is that's running in the cycle. My view is that for the next, you know, certainly for the rest of my lifetime, there's an enormous amount of new change, development, and evolution. And so the opportunities will exist, but there's no question that we will experience cycles, including probably some very aggressive downward cycles. And when those happen, interestingly, if you look back at history, in those down cycles are when some of the next generation of amazing companies get created.
Sure, some of the Googles.
Yeah, it's easy to say when we're in a positive part of the cycle, oh yeah, there will be a down cycle. And when there's a down cycle, here's how you should act. And you know, when there's a down cycle, people don't act that way. So I think one of the things I've tried as I've gotten older and my partners and I talk about all the time is we're in a business and we've, you know, as investors in early stage tech and innovative companies, and we're in a landscape which is the evolution of tech as a major and maybe the dominant influencer on society over the next 20 or 30 years, that should be something that there's enormous amounts of opportunity and regardless of what's happening in the macro.
Yeah, certainly if you look at the number of young people that are trying to start innovative companies, it's, you know, skyrocketed, especially since, you know, when I graduated in 99, it's just a different ecosystem than it was back then when a lot of folks went into other industries.
When I was starting to invest, there was a cliche that, you know, all the investing should happen within your area code, not even your zip code. Like if you're in the 617 area code, why would you ever leave Boston? If you're 212 area code, why would you ever leave New York? And today, the idea that great companies be created all over the world, I think is undeniable. There's still a lot of debate.
Sure.
And for somebody who's in their 20s, that's a totally different message than the message that I was getting in my 20s in the 1980s about what your career should look like.
It's interesting. You bring up kind of geography of the startup ecosystem, and then you're also mentioning Warren Buffett. He said a few times in different articles that being in Omaha was a huge advantage because they didn't get caught in the noise of Wall Street. Do you think that's true as well for you guys at Foundry, being outside of Silicon Valley?
Yes, absolutely. There's a very long number of things that are advantages to us, including a massive time advantage. Between 1996 and 2005, maybe 2006 even, I was in the Bay Area almost every week, 3 out of 4 weeks a month, generally for between 1 and 3 days. Started first thing Monday morning and, you know, usually was there till at least Tuesday or Wednesday. And then in the latter parts of the 1990s, I was co-chair of a public company in New York. And so I take a red eye from California to New York on Tuesday night or Wednesday night and work in New York for, you know, a day or two and then come home on Fridays. The tax on my time of meeting with other people and spending time on what I would classify in retrospect were incredibly low value interactions was very high when I was in the Bay Area. You know, the C and B scene phenomena,
sure.
The spending time meeting with folks because you have to be in the flow of stuff, and the sense that you always had to be in the mix. The concentration of people was valuable, but at the same time, the tax was really substantial. It precluded the ability to really sort of step back and have enough time to really focus energy where you choose to rather than react endlessly to what's going on. And, you know, I think that's a big part of, you know, Buffett's shtick in terms of being in Omaha. You know, for us, it's a different version of that. And we have to travel a lot, and we do travel a lot because our investments are all over the U.S. But, you know, as something like this demonstrates, right, we've worked very hard and technology works in our favor today. It's very easy to be globally connected and be in one place. And, you know, if you've learned how to be a remote worker, which basically I think all of my partners and I had to do because of our planting a flag in Boulder and saying this is where we are, you end up with a very different pattern of how you analyze things and how you react to stuff. And it gives you detachment from the emotions, good and bad, of things that actually don't really matter that much, but are easy to get wound up about.
It seems like it also depends on kind of the person itself. Someone like myself who's introverted, I'd much rather not go to a lot of networking events, whether or not it's helpful. There are some people that believe and are feel natural in those situations that that's how they get deal flow and that's how they meet people and build a network. It sounds like it really depends on the person and that there's different paths to creating that network and brand in the ecosystem.
I think that's well said. There's lots of ways to be successful in this business. And I'm not suggesting, for example, that somebody shouldn't live in the Bay Area if that's what they want to do. And somebody shouldn't spend a lot of time running around, you know, and being in the flow of things if that's what gives them energy and that's what they like doing.
Sure.
It turns out for us, that's not what we like doing. And that's not how we think and how we approach things. And so we've configured our work and our lives to fit with what we like rather than to try to conform to, oh, well, this is the way it's done.
Thanks for listening to my conversation with Brad. He had so much great things to say that we broke it into two podcasts. So subscribe and you'll be able to hear part two when it comes out next week. In episode two, Brad will talk about the biggest reasons that startups fail, sectors that he's bullish on, that the market is bearish, and why startups' greatest strength often become their greatest weakness.